We're on the record. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a short meeting this morning. Today is the, what, the 20, the 30th? The 20, Wednesday the 30th, yes. Wednesday the 30th of March. It's now about 8:38 a.m. All the members of the committee are present. And we're going to just take care of one little bookkeeping item before we go into the rest of the session. And yesterday, as you know, on the Senate floor, we rescinded our action regarding forwarding Skip Cook's name. Well, of ratifying his name on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, because it turns out that his term had not expired and would not expire until January of 2006. In looking at the other interviewee that we had that we voted to forward to the Senate floor for ratification was Marianne Stillner. And for bookkeeping purposes, to get this off of the records or the pending files, I would entertain a motion to rescind our action to forward Marianne Stillner's name to the Senate for ratification for the same reasons that I explained yesterday on the floor. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, I so move as stated.
Okay, the motion has been made to rescind our action of forwarding Marianne Stillner's name for consideration by the entire body to be a public member of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Senator Huggins?
One question, Mr. Chair. Where do you see the miscommunications about the tours of a person on the Board of Commission in this case?
Yesterday morning, we got a fax from the staff of the Select Committee, Joyce Anderson. Ms. Anderson sent me copies of two sets of minutes. I did not bring those with me, but I can parenthetically come pretty close to what they said. And there was a discussion among staff members as to the term. And staff members came to the committee and said, it appears to us that these terms are for 2 years, and said that she had talked with legislative legal, and that the legislative legal that had agreed with her. So there was a subsequent motion made by the staff, by the members of the committee, that the terms were of 2 year duration, and they passed the motion, which I thought was kind of strange. I wasn't there, so I don't, you can only go back and look at the written minutes, but it would appear in the case of trying to interpret a statute like that, that when you have someone from the legislative legal department, that you might follow a little different course of action. In the course of action, when I ran into this in reviewing the statute, I immediately called Tam Cook and said, are you reading this the same way that I do? And then asked for a written opinion to back up my interpretation and her interpretation of the statute so that it would be on file. I couldn't find that existed. It apparently there was, according to the minutes, a conversation that took place, but there's no way for me to deny or verify that conversation. So looking at some of the comments of the members, the minutes were reflected that Senator Torgerson thought it was a two-year term, but Skip Cook thought it was a three-year term. So it was some discussion among those members. It seems to me that the best thing that could have been done at that point would have been to come back to the legislature for clarification, or at least have gotten a written opinion from the legislative legal department through one of the members of the legislature that sits on the committee. But that didn't happen. I don't think anything like that will happen again in the future, but it appears to me to have come from confusion by staff first of how that statute read, and not a lot of time spent in trying to interpret it.
Yeah.
Senator Huggins.
Follow-up. Do you think it's required that we or some written communications between, let's just say, this committee to lay out the understanding of how we got, not where we've been, but for the future, this is a three-year time frame and the expectation of not having nominees come ever what the language that we desire.
Okay. I can, if the committee would like, I'll try to put together a draft that we can send to the legislative committee, the select committee, and tell them our interpretation and what procedure we think they should follow.
I think a letter would be appropriate.
Yeah. So we'll draft that. Is there any additional discussion on the motion?
Well, just, I mean,
Senator French?
I think just for the purposes of putting it out there, this doesn't reflect on Mr. Cook or Ms. Stillner. This is absolutely no discussion of their merits or
in any name.
Right. Yeah. It's just a simple procedural issue that's arisen through an oversight.
Yeah. Okay. Misinterpretation of statute. I think that's, one of the things that caused us to take a look now at all right, what are the procedures in that committee? So with that, unless there's any opposition, the motion passes. And we have rescinded our action. Let's move on. We were on Senate Bill 106, and Senator Guest was doing a yeoman's job working our way through this this bill. I do have some people online, and I've got Senator Guest, who have you got lined up this morning that you wanted to testify?
Well, Sergeant Burt is here, and Cindy Buehler from the pharmacy group is supposed to be online, one of Senator Huggins' constituents.
Why don't I just ask you to call the witnesses that you'd like in order that you want? Lieutenant Stevens, Sergeant Woodward, Cindy Buehler. This is who I show that we have so far.
Have Sergeant Burt come up since he's here and can probably answer a lot of the questions from yesterday.
If you put yourself on the record, sir, and we'll now kind of informally turn any questions, or did you just want to make a comment? We'll allow you to just kind of to begin the process, Senator Guest.
Actually, Sergeant, if you would give whatever testimony you've given in the other committees, and I think my staff gave you some of the questions that came up yesterday, if you can address those.
Mr. Chair, this is Timothy Dean Burt. I'm a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers. The testimony which I provided at some of the other committees had, generally speaking, about the methamphetamine laboratories, the dangers, the hazards to the persons, not only that cook the methamphetamine, the meth cookers, so to speak, but the dangers to the community as well, other persons that may reside within the dwellings or in adjacent dwellings such as apartment buildings and such, that these chemicals that are utilized, they have legitimate retail consumer uses. Most of the chemicals have legitimate uses in household situations, however not all of them, but it's the nature in which these chemicals are brought together, stored, the locations in which they're stored, the chemical byproducts which are generated from combining these various chemicals, and that these chemicals are toxic, flammable, possibly explosive. They can create low oxygen environments. They also create residues which contaminate dwellings. These residues have lifespans that we're not exactly certain how long they'll remain behind in a meth lab scene or how far they'll actually travel. Many of these residues, which are toxic, although in an industrial situation, they have there's designated levels which you can receive an exposure or methods to prevent an exposure. There's also chemicals generated that there is no safe exposure limits or these chemicals are immediately dangerous to life and health. Some of these residues remain behind, and again, these chemicals are extremely dangerous to the persons immediately involved, as well as the persons that may unwittingly be exposed to these chemicals. Pseudoephedrine is the precursor that's involved in the manufacturing of methamphetamine here in Alaska. There's about 150 different recipes for manufacturing methamphetamine. Currently, the trends here in Alaska, we see two trends, one utilizing pseudoephedrine, anhydrous ammonia, and the lithium metal. The other method is pseudoephedrine, iodine, and red phosphorus. The pseudoephedrine, although we don't have any numbers on the amount of pseudoephedrine that's diverted from legitimate use to manufacture methamphetamine, we know that 100% of the methamphetamine that's manufactured in Alaska is manufactured with diverted pseudoephedrine. Again, pseudoephedrine that's diverted from legitimate use to the manufacture of the illegal drug.
Sergeant, there was some discussion I know in the other committees and that I've had with Mr. Stone from your department about 6 grams versus 9 grams. Where does the department fall on, you know, if we're going to put a limit on how many grams, you know, someone can have in their possession or purchase, what that limit should be?
State troopers, not just based on my experience, but experience of many other investigators in these clan lab investigations, although there's been talk and I've seen a benchmark of 9 grams for the pseudoephedrine, we would like to see it lowered down to 6 grams. The lower limit, the lower threshold, we think is going to have a significant impact, more so than the 9 gram threshold. We've spoke with officials from the state of Oregon, and the state of Oregon has a 9 gram threshold. Once that went into effect, our understanding is that they didn't really see an impact upon their meth lab situation at the 9 gram threshold. We know that the state of Iowa recently went to a 7.5 gram threshold, although many of these other states that have gone to these lower thresholds, the thresholds of they've arrived at those in the past, say, approximately a year to a year and a half, so we don't have any hard statistics how it affected other states and their meth lab problem. But we do believe that the lower the threshold is, the more impact we're going to have on the meth lab situation here in Alaska.
Well, if the committee had
other questions from other committees, Senator French.
Thank you, Sergeant Brooke. Thanks for being here this morning. How much meth can you make out of 9 grams of pseudoephedrine?
Through the chair, Senator French, from 9 grams of pseudoephedrine, if I can refer to my notes here. For pseudoephedrine, for each unit that you put into the front of the process of pseudoephedrine, you get approximately 3/4 of a unit out of the back of the process of methamphetamine.
So 9 grams of pseudoephedrine equals 6 grams of meth?
Approximately 6 3/4 grams of meth, correct.
And what's an addict's dosage of meth? You know, is it 1 gram, 2 grams, half a gram?
Through the chair, Senator French, a street level purchase of methamphetamine would be approximately 1 gram. 1 gram volume-wise would be approximately the same amount that you would find in a packet of sugar or sweet and low that you put in your morning coffee. From that 1 gram, that would be divided into 10 equal portions, and one of those portions would be approximately a street level dosage of methamphetamine.
I see. And what is the price, what's the street price of a gram of methamphetamine?
$150.
So you can turn 9 grams of pseudoephedrine into 6 times 150 equals $900 worth of meth, is that right?
Let's see. Through the chair, Senator French, I believe it's about a little over $1,000 in methamphetamine.
Somewhere in there.
Yes.
One, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Right ahead, Senator.
One of the concerns expressed yesterday as the committee was discussing this bill was protecting innocent
purchasers of a lawful product. You don't get a high from taking Sudafed. No one buys Sudafed to get, you know, to experience euphoria. You buy Sudafed so you can beat a cold. And lots of folks use the product on a daily basis because they have sinus problems or some other health condition that requires them to take Sudafed. I imagine you've participated in some meth lab busts, and I would imagine you could walk into a room and look around and see two or three things that tells you this is a meth lab and not, you know, the home of a law-abiding Sudafed user. One of the things we're groping for is being able to differentiate between those two so that people can buy Sudafed, have Sudafed around the house, and not be a felon for possessing a lawful product. And yet we want to clamp down on the usage of this product for meth labs. So I guess what I'm asking you to tell us is, when you walk into a meth lab and look around, what things do you see that tell you, you know, within a minute that you're dealing with a meth lab and not a person suffering from a cold?
Certainly, through the chair, Senator French, any number of things can tell us that there's a meth lab, although very rarely do we rely upon one indicator, such as pseudoephedrine. If we walked in and found an unusual amount of pseudoephedrine, such as 10 boxes of pseudoephedrine, there were smaller amounts of pseudoephedrine, two or three boxes, maybe packaging from previous pseudoephedrine, exceptional amounts of packaging in combination with some of the solvents, the acetones, the toluene, the xylene, xylol, all those are solvents, unusual amounts of, say, sodium hydroxide, red devil eye, sulfuric acids, roto drain cleaner, muriatic acid, pseudoephedrine reduced from the cold tablets in combination with the cold tablets. There's no legitimate reason for reducing pseudoephedrine from the cold tablets except to manufacture methamphetamine, which is not a legitimate purpose for doing that. Also in combination with various cooking items, whether it be hot plates, Pyrex dishes, these dishes and hot plates with residues, fans, hoses, tubing, gas generators. These are all items, and that's not an inclusive list, that all indicate evidence of manufacturing. And again, in my experience of many other investigators, we don't find those items and those combinations in households where people are legitimately using pseudoephedrine and that's all that they have.
One follow-up question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oregon has a savings clause, if you will, in its meth statutes, and the savings clause says something like this. You know, this law doesn't apply to someone whose possession of pseudoephedrine is in the home or the residence of a person under circumstances that are consistent with typical medicinal or household use, as indicated by factors that include but are not limited to storage location, purchase date, possession of the products in a variety of strengths, brands, types, or purposes and expiration date. What would be your reaction to some language like that tried to cut out folks who may just have accumulated a lot of Sudafed over the years, and it's, you know, it's in the RV, you know, first aid kit, it's in the home first aid kit, it's in the kit that you take with you when you go to the cabin, and it's, you know, in various places around your house?
Through the chair, Senator French, I have reviewed that statute in the past couple of weeks. From what I can tell, that might be a viable wording. Again, that gives, an escape clause for those who legitimately possess methamphetamine. And again, if they have, you know, a couple of residences.
Pseudoephedrine.
I misspoke. In regards to having an escape clause for them, yes, I think that's probably wording along those lines would help out. It wouldn't penalize or criminalize those persons who have a legitimate use for the pseudoephedrine.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Senator Terrio.
1 gram of meth, you said, gets divided how many times for a single dosage?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio. Street-level dosage would be divided into approximately 10 portions. Again, that's not necessarily a hard, fast because we're talking about street level dosage depending on the user. And I want to point out that although you might use, say, a packet of sugar in your morning coffee, and that might be one dosage unit for that cup of coffee, these street level users may go through, depending on the user, 3 or 4 grams a day, or one user may use 1 gram in 3 or 4 days.
The questions? Sergeant, thank you very much for your testimony at this point. Senator Guest, you have Cindy next.
Sure. Whoever's on online, in what or whatever order you want, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Cindy Buehr?
Yes.
Cindy, are you there with us this morning then, huh?
Yes, good morning.
If you'll just put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Buehr. I'm a pharmacist in Anchorage, and I'm the current chair of the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy. I believe I can say comfortably that I'm speaking for the board in that at our last board pharmacy meeting, we did resolve to try to encourage legislation such as this to limit the sale of pseudoephedrine. So I have reviewed Senator Guest's Senate Bill 106. I believe that enacting legislation like this can markedly limit the proliferation of methamphetamine labs from looking at examples from other states. And of course, all the inherent public dangers associated with that. And I'm concerned also with the convenience to the public, and I think this can be done with a relatively small inconvenience to the public. With the enactment of this bill. I do have a couple of comments I'd like to make. One, may I mention the escape clause you mentioned in the Oregon legislation? That certainly seems reasonable to me. And from Sergeant Burt's request to limit the amount to 6 grams, that seems reasonable to me. 6 grams equals 6,000 milligrams. A Sudafed tablet is 30 milligrams. That would easily allow a month's supply. That's 200 tablets. That could easily be a legitimate month's supply for someone who is suffering from chronic sinus, allergies, colds, things like that. So I don't think 6 grams would cause undue hardship to the public, especially if combined with sort of escape clause like Oregon has. I do have one other concern for the public, though. I've seen other legislation that makes exception for liquid or gel-filled capsules or multi-ingredient Sudafed products, pseudoephedrine products, excuse me. Let me explain, if someone is going to make methamphetamine, they want straight pseudoephedrine. And most of our cough cold preparations are multi-ingredient. They may have antihistamines, decongestants, cough suppressants. The person who's interested in the pseudoephedrine for making methamphetamine doesn't want that kind of product. So we don't want to be locking up those multi-ingredient products. And similarly, the liquid products. If you, pseudoephedrine is an ingredient in multi-ingredient cough syrup, cold preparations that are in liquid form. It's not easy to extract the pseudoephedrine out of that. I don't believe those are subject to misuse. So I would like to see those available on the shelf for the consumer. Are there any questions about what I just said?
Questions from members. Senator French.
Thank you. Ms. Buehr, this may be a question more for Sergeant Burt, but I'll ask you, is it impossible to make meth out of the liquid, the gel-filled, and the multi-ingredient formulas, or is it just much harder?
You're right. That would be a question for Sergeant Burt, but when I saw it worded such in, for example, the Washington state legislation, that led me to believe that it would be a substantial hurdle to the abuser. Perhaps Sergeant Burt can speak to this.
Thank you.
Sergeant Burt, you have a comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Come on up and take the hot seat again.
Thank you, sir. Senator French, in regards to the cough syrup and gel caps, in our experience, the meth cooks here in Alaska prefer the cold tablets. That seems to be the easiest method to harvest the pseudoephedrine from. Although, is it possible to harvest pseudoephedrine from cough syrup and the gel caps? I can't imagine that it is. I believe that it takes a much more detailed knowledge of chemistry and or apparatus to harvest the pseudoephedrine from the cough syrup and the gel caps versus what we're seeing currently as the trends.
It was a long time ago that I was in chemistry classes in college, but I think I could do it. Be a little more complicated, but you can get anything, you can extract anything with the right processes.
Well, let me just ask the sergeant, in your view, is it do you see a legitimate dividing line between the pure pseudoephedrine, pseudofed, and the liquid, the gel fill, or the multi-ingredient? Do you think we should just focus on the one and not the other, or should we encompass both in the restrictions?
Through the chair, Senator French. At this time, I don't have any knowledge that we're finding the cough syrup or the gel caps in meth labs here in Alaska. It's strictly the cold tablets. So I guess on those lines, yes, we can separate the two products. And if the cough syrup or cold or the gel caps become a problem in the future, we could probably address it at that time.
Thank you. So, Sergeant, in effect, what we're saying here is there doesn't seem to be the great public threat of having combined products on the shelf, but the pure product is what we're most concerned about at this particular time because of the current methodology of manufacturing methamphetamines.
Mr. Chair, in my experience, meth cooks are utilizing the cold tablets that have the pseudoephedrine. They may utilize pseudoephedrine that has guaifenesin in it as well.
Okay.
The guaifenesin, having reviewed lab reports from finished methamphetamine from these labs, does carry over into the finished product. I'm not sure the various combinations that pharmaceutical companies could come up with in combination with the pseudoephedrine products. But in my experience, primarily they're after the pseudoephedrine based product.
It seemed to me, again, I'm trying to recall a long time back when I was in a number of chemistry classes in college, that you could still get an interaction with the active ingredient of pseudoephedrine, and even with those other materials there, it might not interfere with the actual production of methamphetamine, but it may be polluted methamphetamine. It may still have those other materials in it. As it still may be methamphetamine with Tylenol because of the chemical reaction that would take place with the combined product or with the element, with the pseudoephedrine in the combined product. So you're saying, in effect, that the lab analyses have shown that is the case in some instances?
Mr. Chair, certainly those products that were in the cold tablets in the beginning have carried through to the finished product. The finished product is still methamphetamine. It's, as you stated earlier, methamphetamine with either guaifenesin or some other cutting agent. I don't know if the other products pharmaceutical companies may put in would actually carry through to the end process or not, but the pseudoephedrine would still be converted to methamphetamine.
Yeah, so there's no indication or any reliable information that the presence of the other products would block the chemical process of producing methamphetamine from the pseudoephedrine in the combined product.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any products that are in combination with pseudoephedrine in these cold tablets that block the manufacture of methamphetamine.
Okay, so you just might have methamphetamine that also takes away your headache with Tylenol.
Certainly.
So to speak. So I guess that's all the questions I have at the moment. Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Sergeant Byrd, if we do everything this bill says, and number one, I support
you know, killing meth labs and incarcerating those that are running them. But if we do everything that this bill says, what degree do you think we're going to impact meth labs?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think we have an opportunity here to have a significant impact on meth labs, our investigations into those labs, and identifying suspects that are either cooking themselves or participating, supplying chemicals to these labs. Significant impact.
If I might just make the analogy, you know, we all now go through a checkpoint and take our shoes off at the airport based on an occurrence once upon a time. I'm not trying to be flippant. But my assumption are those people that want to do things and use airplanes or be a passenger to be a part of that in the terrorist activities, they have now studied the profiling of how we are doing our security, and they've moved well past the tennis shoes with explosives in them. Do you see that sort of thing happening once this legislation goes into place, if it does?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, in respect to
meth labs.
Yes, to meth labs. But in respect to being able to profile or identify meth cooks, is that...
Well, we make it more difficult in this case by the technique we're describing to get the ingredients off the shelf, okay? The question is then what will the approach... Because meth lab people are pretty smart, pretty persistent, and, oh, by the way, they like meth. So they're going to figure out some way to continue to make meth labs work, is my assumption. If I'm wrong, tell me. I mean,
through the chair, Senator Huggins, you're certainly right in that meth cooks are very persistent, and as we make it more difficult through one avenue, they may find another avenue. Again, it's backyard chemistry on manufacturing methamphetamine. Now, although I haven't had an opportunity to completely digest this bill, I believe that there's language indicating a register in which persons purchasing pseudoephedrine would have to provide government ID and identify themselves when they purchase to the retailer when they purchase pseudoephedrine products. Those registers, if available to law enforcement, would help us tremendously enabling us to identify these persons who are purchasing for illegitimate means. Yes, there are going to be persons on the list that have legitimate uses for the pseudoephedrine, but being able to view these lists, again, we will be able to highlight these persons that are purchasing unusual amounts or the pseudoephedrine products, or live at the same address where unusual amounts of pseudoephedrine is being funneled towards. It would help us tremendously.
One last question. In regards, if you recall, sometime back we had the ruling on marijuana and usage in your home and privacy and things of that nature. In your law enforcement considerations and looking at the system, do you have any concern about that same judge making the same ruling on methamphetamines?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, no, I don't. And the reason for that is that although there's some concerns regarding marijuana and personal use and privacy in the home, marijuana does not offer up the same dangers to not only the individual but the community itself and those outside the home or the residence, adjoining residences, through the toxic natures of these chemicals and explosive natures and things like this.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Sergeant, on the registry list, do you have any information? I think, what is it, Oklahoma that has a registry list?
I believe so.
Do you have any information from the people in Oklahoma that would indicate that that list has been helpful to them?
Mr. Chair, the information that I've reviewed indicates that the registry has been helpful since they passed their methamphetamine or their pseudoephedrine reduction law. They've seen a significant impact upon the meth labs, reduction in meth labs that they're seizing in their state.
Could you give me, based on your experience, somewhat of an economic profile of the average person that you see manufacturing methamphetamine?
Mr. Chair, economic profile, I would say low income or lower income, typically in residences which they don't own, which they're renting. Numerous vehicles, various states of disrepair, maybe a couple vehicles that do in fact run, residences that contain junk, clutter, outside and inside the residence, some residences in which the normal average person would shudder to live in or even walk through or enter. These residences are typically in states of disrepair.
Why are they manufacturing the product?
Mr. Chair, two reasons to manufacture methamphetamine. One is addiction, and oftentimes that's where it starts, is a person start off on a street level dosage and then get hooked on methamphetamine and they begin using. The other is the economic factor. For a $100 investment in chemicals and hardware, you can manufacture in $1,000 worth of methamphetamine. The turnover on your investment is incredible. Once you are able to, say, hook up and have customers that are also addicted to the product is extremely addictive. They will come to you for more product, and you can literally make thousands of dollars a month, tens of thousands of dollars a year manufacturing methamphetamine.
Yesterday we heard that a pharmacist tell us that he could hook up online and buy pseudoephedrine probably at four times the cost of what he has to pay for it otherwise and have it shipped to him in-state from out-of-state sources. Have you seen that anywhere in your experience?
Mr. Chair, in my experience, I've seen and see numerous documents from meth labs where meth cooks are actually doing research on the internet for recipes, sources for chemicals. Have I seen that specific website or source? No, I have not.
I mean, you have seen, though, where people have purchased large quantities of pseudoephedrine via the internet that has been shipped in out of state? Have you seen that?
Personally, I haven't seen that, Mr. Chair.
It's interesting that it's available out there and that the price is high, so someone knows, the supplier obviously knows someone's desperate to get it in a surreptitious manner. So in my opinion, the supplier that's doing that probably is has a darn good idea of what it's going to be used for. I'm wondering, has there... one of the things that I have a problem with is trying to put unnecessary restrictions on legitimate businesses to the point where by accident of who they hire, they violate a statute. They become a criminal because one of their $7.50 an hour clerks didn't feel like writing down who bought this package of pseudoephedrine last night about midnight at the 7-Eleven store. Also, shippers that, for example, FedEx or one of the overnight companies that may pick up a package someplace and ship it by their normal route to someone in the middle of Alaska, maybe into a remote area of Alaska. But is there any way that you know of that, for an example, a shipper who would know? Is there a way for them to identify the contents of a package that would include pseudoephedrine in there, and that's the only thing that's in there, basically, that would be sent to someone at a remote location somewhere else? And again, obviously, not because their whole family has a cold, but because they're trying to use it to manufacture methamphetamines. Is there a way for the shippers to know the content of a package?
Mr. Chair, my experience and knowledge tells me that there's no way for a shipper to look at the package on the outside and or in, possibly on an invoice there may be a listing of what's inside the package, but again, across the board for the shipper to look at that and know what's inside of it, not that I know of. Many of these pharmaceutical warehouse companies, retailers, may have names that indicate they're a pharmaceutical supply company, and many of them have names that you wouldn't have any idea that they're involved in pharmaceuticals.
So it would seem to me that if we were going to put a registration restriction or requirement on retailers of the product, that
it would be equally as effective on the other front then once that product, once that source starts to dry up, if it does from our actions, that we put some kind of restriction on the other market, the four times as expensive market that would be shipped in. Have you ever given, have you noted if there's any consideration in other state laws anywhere regarding the pharmaceutical companies, the suppliers that ship, identifying what the product is and telling shippers, hey, unless you have, unless this is being shipped to a legitimate retailer of the product, you can't send pseudoephedrin, you can't deliver it to individuals along that line?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any other state laws, other states regarding that. I don't know if any consideration has been given towards that here in Alaska.
No, I'd have to look, but I think, don't we have some kind of restriction or something along that line having to do with tobacco products that come into the state that try to avoid the tax?
You got to have a stamp.
There's got to be a stamp somewhere. Is that? I'm just saying, you know, if we dry up this supply route, and we leave a big door open for the other one, even though it's more expensive, you're saying that the economic reward for that additional expense is easily offset. So it would seem to me that if I was an addict or I was someone who wanted to manufacture the product for resale at a good gain, that, you know, so what if I have to pay four times as much for the raw product if I'm getting 10 times the economic value of the product in the final form. So I would just kind of say if we were going to try to dry up this, I think Charlie said it right, or Senator Huggins said it right, that they're going to find a new way to bomb the airplane. It might not be in the sole of a tennis shoe, but it'll be somewhere else. And if we see, we know that this other route is there, that they can acquire the raw product and probably do it without any scrutiny. It's just going to be delivered in a brown paper box from some place in middle of Kansas that we're overlooking that side of it. I don't know, Senator Guess, you follow where I'm going there. And that if we're going to really try to dry up the supply, we ought to look at all the different possible routes in the process. If we're going to make pharmacists put it behind their counter, what are we going to do with the guys online? Is my question. Any comment or answer on that? Sorry,
Mr. Chair. At this time, I don't have an answer for you on regarding online email type obtaining pseudoephedrine. I do know that currently, primarily, what we're seeing is the pseudoephedrine being obtained from the retail outlets. But I think looking ahead, trying to forward thinking on where they would go, it's an outstanding point. I just don't have an answer for you.
Senator French and then Senator Huggins.
On that point, what's been the Oklahoma experience or the experience in other states? Obviously, they've encountered the same problem. They've shut down their local sales. Meth addicts probably didn't go away overnight. Are they seeing huge increases in mail order sales in those states where over the counter sales are restricted?
Through the chair, Senator French, one of the trends that Oklahoma noticed was that an increase in pseudoephedrine sales in adjoining states, persons just going across the border to obtain pseudoephedrine and skirt the law of Oklahoma. Alaska is quite a bit more isolated than that. It'd be more difficult, although I would imagine that it can certainly be shipped up in luggage and what have you, just as the methamphetamine product is itself. Aside from that, I don't have any knowledge or experience on Oklahoma or how they may have addressed or the trends that they see regarding the internet.
Senator Huggins.
Well, Mr. Chair, you hit exactly on the point that I was trying to make, that my concern is what we do make it more difficult for Senator Guest to go down and buy medicine for her cold, because the net effect was these people, if they are addicted and they are persistent and there's a market, then they will go to alternative sources and it will just be a minor speed bump. So if we're going to do this, I would much prefer that we do it comprehensively so that we look at all the pressure point factors that, to best of our ability, and we do that in a failed swoop so that we don't come back next year and we say, golly, you know, it's hard to get cold medicine, and meth production went down a little bit and it's now back up because you can buy it in bulk from whatever the source is in Canada or Kansas or New York City. And that's my concern, because I mean, I think all of us in this room, if we pay attention to what these people are doing, and if they are in fact addicted, they have a driving force that equals initiative that says they're going to continue if we don't look at the multiple approaches they have for ephedrine. That's my concern, that we might as well just get on and do it comprehensively if we're going to do it.
I have that. That's my problem. It just seemed to me that we have we're taking a position here where it's going to make it harder for a retailer in the state of Alaska, but we're leaving this wholesale door wide open, and we're, you know, and I'm just wondering what kind of force of law we can put on someone who imports into the state of Alaska, either through the shipper, through the wholesaler, or anyone else, of a known pseudoephedrine product, and restrictions we can put on law against, in law in Alaska, effective and constitutional restrictions we can put on someone to identify what they're bringing in and prohibit their bringing certain materials in. You know, because it's not in the mail anymore. It's Big Brown and FedEx that are bringing it in. You know, and yes, and I hate to put onerous restrictions on anyone, but if we're going to do it on the corner drugstore, we ought to be able to do something about stopping FedEx. Senator French.
Maybe a question for our esteemed Senator Murkowski, who will be addressing us quite soon.
Yeah. But you can see, I think everyone here, and maybe this is a good point for us to go ahead, Senator Guest. You had a question for us to recess here for the day, because we're going to have to clear out so that Senator Murkowski can take over our meeting space.
Senator Seekins, is there a Ms. Adams? She's a constituent.
Oh, Ms. Adams, Marlena Adams.
Maybe if she could testify.
Let's do that. Marlena, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you would put yourself on the record and introduce yourself to us, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Okay. My name is Marlena Adams. I'm 24 years old, and I live in Wasilla, Alaska, and I'd like to share my story with you. In 2003, I was addicted to methamphetamine. And that addiction and my association with those people, the cooks, the dealers, and other addicts, almost cost me my life. I became heavily involved in the meth world in the spring of 2003. I was staying up 3 and 5 days, sometimes a week at a time. I was dropping a considerable amount of weight at a very unhealthy rate. In the space of a few months, meth had become what I believe to be a staple in my life, much like food or water. On September 21st, 2003, I got into the shower at my apartment and left 3 individuals who were also addicts waiting in my living room. I got out 30, 45 minutes later and opened the bathroom door to a noxious chemical smell. I followed the smell into the kitchen, where I saw that my oven had been turned on to boil. The oven door was closed, and there was heat containers, a gasoline additive, all over my kitchen floor. I opened the oven door, and its contents burst into flames, spraying my hands and arms, catching them on fire. When I tried to close the oven door, it blew up, dislocating my right knee, throwing me into the upper cabinets on the other side of the kitchen, and covering me from head to toe in flammable liquid. I was dragged out of the kitchen and put out with a fire extinguisher by one of the people there, but not before 47% of my body received third-degree burns. A neighbor who had responded to the explosion got a garden hose at my direction and sprayed me to cool down my skin, which was literally boiling before my eyes. I was ambulanced to Valley Hospital, where I was then airlifted to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. I spent 9 weeks there, 7 of them in the intensive care unit, where I had to relearn how to walk, feed myself right, and even go to the bathroom. I have done multiple skin grafts, the last of which left 90% of my body with open wounds. I had 5 surgeries before I left Washington in December of 2003. The last of my open wounds finally healed in June of 2004, more than 9 months later. Since I have been home, I have had 4 more surgeries to remove staples that were missed during the grafting process, and I am due to have my 11th surgery that is able to correct damage to my right foot caused by the burns. I was told by the doctors in Washington that if I had not had waist-long wet hair, I probably would not be alive today. As for the 3 people that were at my home with me, 2 immediately ran away. The only person who put me out was there when the police and ambulance arrived, and only because the neighbor with the garden hose chased him down when he ran away. I still don't know exactly what happened that day, who put that stuff into my oven, or why. I don't know if I ever will. I don't know if they were trying to hurt me or if they were trying to extract a settlement. I do know that aside from illegal and detrimental to the body, meth seriously alters the user's hold on reality and moral standpoint. I believe that users become vicious, paranoid, and delusional. The cooks, the people that manufacture methamphetamine, in my experience, have been very cunning and persuasive individuals. They will recruit people to work for them by shopping for the supplies they need in return for the drug. Oftentimes, cooks frequently move their labs, only staying in the same place a week or less. Low-priced or run-down motels where high traffic will go unnoticed is also commonplace for these people, who have little, if any, regard for the well-being of others. These ruthless people run rampant, spreading addiction like a plague, addiction to a drug that destroys minds, bodies, and lives. I believe that these people are not going to stop manufacturing meth without intervention. I believe that limiting their access to many of the vital precursors, such as ephedrine and pseudoephedrine and products containing these chemicals, is a great first step. I would also like it to be known that I agree with the 6 grams instead of 9. In response to waiting to include wholesalers that I heard you discussing earlier, I think that it's very important to implement this law as quickly as possible to limit meth production in the valley and all over the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Marlena? Seeing that, we appreciate your appearing before the committee today, Marlena. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, and this is a good point for us to recess. We do have committed to leave the room today, so with nothing further, the committee is adjourned.